The Tom Woods Show, episode 878.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, if your email inbox is taking over your life, manage it with SaneBox.com. Check out SaneBox.com/Woods and get a 2-week free trial plus an automatic 25 smacker discount. Hello, everybody. Tom Woods here, talking about Ireland today and Ireland's very, very interesting history. People have called it anarchism in Ireland. Well, whatever you want to call it, the legal system that prevailed in Ireland for many centuries is quite different from what we're familiar with in Western civilization today. And it is, it sounds more like something out of a Murray Rothbard book than anything else. And I wanted to talk about that subject because a lot of times people say, oh, there's no way you could have the kind of system you libertarians are describing. Why we need the state for X, Y, and Z. But this is a very, very interesting and I rather suspect little known counterexample. And joining us to talk about this is a man who has spent a good deal of time and a good number of years researching and speaking about this. And that's Kevin Flanagan, who is program manager at European Students for Liberty. He's also director and instructor at the Brehon Law Academy. I will be linking to his material at tomwoods.com/878. Kevin, welcome to the show.
Hello, Tom. Thank you very much for inviting me on. It's a pleasure to be speaking with you.
I did a video not too long ago with a professor from University College Dublin called, I don't remember what the video was called, but it had to do with Irish anarchism. Mm-hmm. And he was insisting that for 2,000 years, Ireland had nothing that we would recognize as a state, and he went on and described it. But it was a short little video. Then I came across your material just very recently, and you've given quite a number of talks, and you've researched this at great length, and I think you really are the go-to guy on it. So start off by giving me what would be your opening statement if you had 2 minutes to give me the overview of what Ireland was like in the sense of its legal system, how it was different from what we are accustomed to in the rest of the West.
Well, first of all, I actually did see that video that you done with Gerard Casey. And since then, I've been in contact with Gerard Casey. And that was one of the important parts of my own journey, I think, of combining the awareness that I had about the early Irish history with my libertarian perspective. So if I'm to sum it up in very brief terms, what I often say, particularly to Irish people when I speak about this, is that the Ireland that they know of today was not the Ireland that their ancestors enjoyed. The Ireland of their ancestors was completely different because it was a decentralized society. What that means is there wasn't one nation or, let's say, one flag or one lawgiver or one government that had control of the entire country. Rather, it operated in this decentralized way where we had more than 100 kind of socioeconomic hubs, which we called tua, and each tua was made up of a number of individual families. What's interesting about the Irish system, and we actually see this mirrored in our modern constitution, was the idea of the family unit being the kind of central focal point for all socio or economic or legal matters. So each family was afforded the dignity and the respect by other families of being treated as a sovereign entity. Family affairs were conducted internally. They elected their own representative or chieftain or spokesperson from among the eligible family members. And the law that kind of was the, let's say, the bedrock or the fabric that knit this whole society together was a law that we call today the Brehon Law. And these were principles that we are very familiar with today. This is what I think is one of the more fascinating aspects of it, that these principles such as freedom of contract and fair trial and things like this were present back then, and they were a very important part of the legal system. But the sort of obligations or duties that one would have within society came partially from their station in life, duties to your family, duties father to son or to the elderly and so on, but also partly to your wider community. And these are duties that we know very well. They are, you could say, written on the heart, which is you don't cause harm, loss, or injury to your fellow man when you're going about your business. Another crucial aspect that ties into all of this was the role of reputation. Reputation is something that's crucially important, which I think has lost its meaning a lot in the modern world. Back then, we have the idea of, you know, you shake on something, it meant something. Your word was your bond. Your word was a really powerful thing. And people were given respect within society based on the amount of contribution, based on their, you know, level of actual respect that they had achieved from their peers. This also played a role in the legal system because those who were of higher status were held to a higher standard, which seems very logical and very natural. Those of a lower status were held to a lower standard. So to sum it up really briefly, a man of a high rank would always be fined more than a man of a low rank for a similar crime. And this makes sense. I mean, if you want to like parallel it to the modern system, I wonder why we have politicians in Ireland, for example, who make terrible decisions, yet they continue in their post because they're not held to a higher standard. They're held actually, ironically, to seemingly a lower standard in society. So this kind of interplay between, you know, family relationships, the rule of law, and one's reputation were really the driving factors behind this system that helped to make it work in the absence of a state.
Let's talk about a theme that is common in discussions among anarcho-capitalists about what justice and what getting justice for someone would look like in a stateless society, and that involves restitution versus retribution. And I'm curious about exactly what role that played in the Breton law.
I mean, this is an excellent question, and it's one of my more favorite points about this. To just put a little bit of historical context in here and legal context, when we think about the system today, when somebody commits a crime, I mean, let's say the uninitiated or those who haven't spent a lot of time studying law might be forgiven for assuming that a crime meant harm against an individual. But when we look at the legal definition of a crime, we realize that's not actually what's meant in a statist society. A crime is an offense against society as a whole, and then the state steps in as the injured party in a court case and basically uses the mechanisms of the state, the police force, enforcement mechanisms, debt collection, all of these things, in order to take compensation for the state, which should be rightly due to the victim. Now, this concept, I mean, it's kind of, I think when you lay it out and put it on paper, it does seem a bit baffling, but it was completely alien to the early Irish. You couldn't have a case without an injured party who was able to stand and put their hand up and say, look, I have been wronged by this man and I want compensation. So our system today, we use prisons as a means of dealing with, you know, criminal, quote unquote, criminal behavior. But really what we're doing when we use prisons like nonchalantly like this, I mean, maybe there is a place for prisons in general, but using them for very like non-violent offenses, let's say political offenses for maybe speeding or littering and not having a television license, as happens in Ireland. These sort of offenses would be, I mean, they wouldn't be compatible in a normal sense of criminal law. So in the Irish system, the way it worked was, I mean, if somebody was aggrieved, they felt to be aggrieved. When somebody does something wrong to you in any part of your life, it's generally something that you feel in your gut. It's not a nice feeling. You've just been betrayed. You've just been wronged. So this was kind of, let's say, symbolic of a wrong that was within the community, not to the community, but somebody within the community has been wronged. So what they did in Ireland is they consulted the advice of a learned class of scholars who were known as the Bretons. The word Breton simply is the Irish word for a judge. So it was what you might call a critarchy. We had sort of a learned class of people who spent a lot of time, up to 20 years, who were studying the customs and the principles that were established by the people. And this is crucial. They were not being established by the king or the higher ranks. It was established by the people. And your role as a Brehon was simply to find a remedy that would restore that imbalance, that would restore that feeling of hardship, that feeling of wrongdoing being held by the victim. And they found that the most, like the easiest way to do this was to give a financial compensation. And this could be for all manner of offences, whether it was injury by accident or design. And even, and this, there's a whole debate around whether this is appropriate or not, but even in the case of death, if you had accidentally or willfully killed a member of another family, well then the family members were the rightful victims to claim the loss that you had incurred to their unit. And this was again calculated financially. So you could imagine somebody who committed such a crime being in debt for much of their life to pay off, to restore, let's say, this family to the position they were in before the offence took place.
Well, I bet there'd be some people who would wonder if under a system like that, where it was a financial compensation that someone had to do to make things right, wouldn't the rich person who was a sadist just go around plucking people's eyes out or something, just figuring he could pay the penalty? Would you deal with that partly through this method you were mentioning before, that people of higher means or who, people who are higher up on the scale would have more severe penalties? How do you deal with that?
Absolutely. That's exactly how they done it. That the penalty for the offence for someone of higher rank was found in such a way that it would become a deterrent for them to behave in such a way. But let it like not be mistaken that I really am speaking about a utilitarian, a utopian system here. I mean, it wasn't perfect. There was obviously problems with power struggles. There was obviously problems with corruption as well. But all in all, the self-regulating nature of the legal system was such that it kept that to mostly a minimum, and it was like family feuds and stuff like that did happen. But to put it into context, after the fall of the Roman Empire, during the Christian era of Ireland, Ireland was colloquially named as the land of the saints and the scholars. This was at a time when we didn't have a state. This is at a time when we today might refer to it as an anarchic system. But to maybe give an example of, because you're hitting on a really important point here, but what if those who are powerfully wealthy in society, well, how would the law not kind of be unjust to those who are less fortunate or less well off? One example of this was a custom that we had called Trosgood. Trosgood could be translated to mean fasting for justice, and it was hunger striking. And what's I find an interesting parallel with this in the modern times, I mean, you might remember the hunger blocks, the H block hunger strikers in Northern Ireland in the 80s. I mean, the hunger strike as a means of kind of like, how would I say, an individual's way of campaigning for personal justice is a very ancient custom in Ireland. And how it worked in relation to the poor people versus the wealthy people is that a poor person would fast from dawn till dusk outside the home of a wealthy person. And this was felt to compel the wealthy person to justice. And if they ignored the hunger strike, and just to bear in mind, they went home when it got dark and they had some food when they went home, but it was more of a symbolic, function of the legal process. If you were a wealthy person and you ignored that, then the rate of your fine would increase threefold. Not only that, and this is probably, this next feature I'm about to mention is probably where we're lacking the most today, that would be hard to bring back such a system, was that you also had the social pressure of your community, who would be like appalled that you would ignore somebody who was fasting on your doorstep. They'd be so appalled that they'd be less inclined to, you know, do business with you in the marketplace. They might not want to sell you food from their shop. So that was a bigger kind of, an enforcement mechanism that wasn't state-based or wasn't centralized, but required a sort of a communal or a social aspect of consciousness that we as a society condemn certain types of behavior.
I'm curious to know about exactly what happened to this system, and that's what I'm going to ask you after we thank our sponsor. Folks, I don't know if you're like me, but I have an email problem. I don't know what to do about it. I get hundreds and hundreds of emails, and it's tempting to just say, to heck with all of it. But I know I need it. I know I need to sort through it. And the answer is Sanebox.com. That's right. Our robot overlords will help us sort through our email. Sanebox.com learns how to distinguish my important email from my unimportant email. It segregates some of my email into folders that I designate so that I can look at it later at my leisure. Or there are some folders where I choose never to see particular kinds of email ever again. Or I can tell Sanebox, you know, I'm on vacation for a few days, hold my email, and then resend it to me when I'm ready. Or I don't really want to deal with this person today, I want to get a good night's sleep and deal with this person tomorrow, re-email this to me tomorrow. And that way I can say I've gone through all my email, it's all cleared out, and I'm ready to go. Fantastic. Well, check it out at sanebox.com/woods and get yourself a 14-day free trial. And if you decide to carry on with Sanebox, you'll get a 25-smacker discount as a Tom Woods Show listener automatically. Check it out at Sanebox, that's S-A-N-E-B-O-X, sanebox.com/woods. All right, so you've described a system that's very interesting, that almost sounds like it's straight out of a Murray Rothbard book in a way. And yet today, if I go to Ireland, that's not what I find. So something happened at some point. What was that thing and when was it?
This is an excellent question, and I'm afraid you might be opening a can of worms here. But you're right. I mean, Rothbard mentions this. I know David Friedman talks about this and others. But the law was never voluntarily left. When I say the law, I mean the old law, the Breton law. The people never gave up that law in place of a better system. It was systematically over a period of several hundred years, step by step, piece by piece, replaced by the colonial legal system of England, the English common law. And just to give you a bit of context on this, I mean, the English, well, at the time it wasn't the English, it was the Anglo-Normans, invaded in the latter half of the 1100s. And the complete conquest, you could say, was completed in the 1700s, 17th century. So there was many hundreds of years of history here, but to just kind of skim over these. In 1366, the then King of England issued a piece of legislation in Ireland called the Statutes of Kilkenny. And the reason he issued this is because the English settlers, the lords and nobles who had been commissioned by the crown to come to Ireland and settle in previously Irish family lands and take ownership and become the lords of these places, they had begun to speak the Irish language. They had begun to wear their hair like the Irish, nice and long and wild. They rode their horses with no saddles like the Irish did. But the most important thing and the reason for this law was that the English settlers had started to go to the Breton law for dispute resolution. So I give this as an example to show two things. One, that the legal system of Ireland, the cultural native system, was a threat to the common law system of England. But most importantly is that the English people who came here, they felt that themselves, and they seen the benefit in this law and began to move over to this other system. And through a series of different policies of the crown throughout history, they had a system called surrender and regrant, where the Irish chieftain would surrender to the crown and he would have his lands granted back to him under an English title. So this was happening for several hundreds of years. It wasn't really until the Battle of Kinsale. It was the last stand of the Irish chieftains who were defeated and then they left Ireland, that we were left with no way of, let's say, the old legal system being supported, and it just kind of died out. There was no way to get justice in the old system anymore, and we were replaced with the English common law courts, which we have to this day. When I was researching this many years ago, I came across an interesting quote from a barrister, an Irish barrister, who said that the Irish irreverence for law doesn't stem from a sympathy with crime or wrongdoing in general, but rather the Irish, who have a very long memory, know that the law in Ireland today is not Irish law. However just it may be, and it was once most unjust, it does not command respect as a native institution nowadays. So, I mean, I think that in modern Irish, I mean, you know, the Irish have this reputation, the fighting Irish, we are seen to be maybe a bit of a rowdy bunch, I don't know. But this, I think, stems from the awareness of the struggle that has gone on in the country, maybe never coming to terms with that as a people. But also because we know, like in our hearts, that this legal system is not really our legal system. So I often say to Irish people, though, that like not all hope is lost, that we do see some traits of the Breton law still in Irish society today, not in the legal system or the institutions of the state, but very much in the personality of the people themselves. The fact that the Irish are seen to be the land of a thousand welcomes and very friendly. Well, under our native legal system, it was illegal not to be friendly. It was illegal not to engage in the rules of hospitality. So this could be something left over. One other feature I can mention on this, the Irish system, because we had this sort of a social incentive to suppress crime, if somebody came into our community and was robbed or mugged and nobody knew who the offender was, well then the whole community became liable to put that victim into the place they were in before the offence happened. And a couple of years ago we had a football match here in Dublin, Ireland versus Austria, in an international football match. Two Austrian fans who were seeing some sights, went to the Guinness factory and so on. They got mugged and their wallets got stolen and their tickets for the football match got stolen. When the Irish fans heard about this, they immediately responded. Nobody had to tell them what to do. They didn't need to have a centralized committee or government or any executive board telling them what to do. They felt in their hearts that the right thing to do would be to do a whip around. Everybody, they did a collection. They got the money back for the people who'd been robbed, and they got in touch with the Football Association of Ireland and got them replacement tickets. It was in the newspaper. It was a nice news story that day. And I use this as an example to say that, like, there's elements of this, like, imperative towards justice is actually in all of us, and we still see kind of remnants left over in Ireland today, despite the fact, I mean, it wasn't just the Crown, it was the Crown and the Vatican, really had a hugely detrimental role in the development of this country's institutions.
All right, now let me ask, I guess, what a lot of people are probably thinking. This is a great history lesson, and a lot of us didn't know anything about it. But is that all it is? Or is there anything we can genuinely learn from it that might make our own lives better today?
I mean, that's another great question.
I'm good at that, by the way. That's why I'm...
Yeah, here. I noticed. I do look at it from two perspectives, actually. I do, on one hand, see it as a nice kind of niche piece of history that is interesting to visitors to Ireland and Irish people alike. But I wouldn't be motivated to be putting the sort of work that I am putting into it unless I felt that there was some sort of like practical payoff for today's society. There are a couple of features. I mean, I think changing our attitude in the courts from retribution to restitution would be one of them. Maybe a greater focus on like reputation-based outcomes to disputes. That's another one. But one hugely important one that I'm sure you'll love and your listeners to your show will love is that we didn't have a centralized body of judges. Like, we didn't have a panel of Supreme Court judges who got put into that position because they favored the current political establishment or anything like that. In fact, the judges were very independent. It was like they had their own trade or their own craft. So one argument that I would make for today's society that could greatly improve what we're doing is to have judicial market opening. Today, if you commit an offence, you're brought before a judge. You have no idea who this judge is. You don't know if he's a good man, a bad man, or what his predisposition is towards you or your background or your race or anything like that. You're just put in front of a man, he's wearing a black dress, and he's going to tell you what to do. But in Ireland, a defendant, actually, I should point out, it wasn't the victim, it was the defendant, picked who the judge would be over a given situation. This created an incentive in judges not to have the most political favor, but actually to be the best at interpreting the principles of the society, of the community that were made by those people, customary law, in a way that was conducive to finding the proper remedy. So if you wanted to be a wealthy judge, if you wanted to get a lot of business, well, then you had to develop a reputation where you were the fairest, you were impartial, you were unbiased, and you were best at interpreting those laws.
All right, hold on, but let me jump in there. Are you telling me that the defendant could choose the judge? Then wouldn't that give us a judge who would tend to be biased in favor of defendants?
If the judge happened to be, the reason why the defendant picked the judge is because it was like another feature of fairness, if you want. Like, I'm going to accuse you of stealing from me, and you're going to say, well, I'm going to pick this judge over here because I know he has a good reputation. But the judge also stood to suffer a loss if he gave an incorrect or an unfair or inaccurate judgment. So if you and I had a dispute, which I hope we never will, but if we did, we could go and consult a Brehon. He would have to put up a portion of the amount being disputed, which was about a third of the amount. So he actually stood to lose financially, first of all, reputationally, second of all. And if he did lose his reputation, then he's losing his business. So even in the case where the defendant picked the judge still had an incentive to be fair. Where this comes into most, I think, is most interesting is if you were a foreigner to my TUA, to my economic hub, and we had a dispute, even as an outsider, you still had the right to pick who would be the judge and oversee the case.
All right. So the problem in the current system is the judges are decided on the basis of politics. And some judges, you know, some judges are too lenient, some people might say, and some judges are too harsh because they want to be able to, some of them are elected. They want to run on, I'm tough on crime. But it's more than that. It's that the whole system is aimed toward retribution rather than restitution, which, by the way, is why I think the discussion in the United States about so-called private prisons misses the whole point. And it's not that we want to privatize every single thing the state does. The state does a lot of bad things. I don't want a super efficient private version of what the state does. And it's the same thing, by the way, with safety at the airports. People say we want to privatize the security agency at the airports, but I don't want private people carrying out government orders either. I want the orders themselves to be issued privately by airlines that are assessing the costs and benefits of having certain policies they impose on their passengers. Is that the way you see things? What I just described, that it's not so much that we want that today, the problem is that the judges are too harsh or the judges are too lenient. It's that they're enforcing a system that's all screwy. In the same way that at the airports, it's not that we have a government agency running the security. It's even if I had private agency running the security, it's the whole system that's screwy. I want private agents to be also making the rules themselves, not just enforcing government rules. See my point?
Of course, yeah. I mean, I hear what you're saying. I think from my limited analysis of all of this, you know, looking at the past and looking at today, I think one of the things that's happened is we have, you know, strayed very far from principle. And a lot of what we do is kind of, play acting, if you want. Like, we have the illusion of a working and functioning justice system. We have the illusion of security. But when you scrape away that, scratch at the surface of that, we find a mess underneath it. And I think one of the biggest problems for this is accountability. We talk about the courts as being available to everybody. You can get your justice in the courts, but it's not entirely true if you don't have the time or the resources to take a TSA agent to court who has, you know, done something untowards when you were going through security. I mean, a lot of the time people are being precluded from finding justice simply on the circumstances of it. But if we kind of, you know, combined or had this attitude of reputation, where reputation is, it's not sort of an abstract idea, it's more concrete. I often say that the only thing worse than a hierarchy is not recognizing a hierarchy of rights and duties and, you know, obligation when they actually exist. So there's I think that's part of the problem. Like, if you have a bad judge or if you have a bad TSA operative, like, what do you do? What can you do about it? And your hands, I think your hands feel tied a lot of the time. And I mean, one of the other points that you mentioned about prison as well, and this is an objection that I get quite often, is like, well, you know, are we going to be using prisons, private or otherwise, as a way of kind of like altering behavior? Or is it like, I think we need to ask the question of what are we trying to achieve through these processes of justice and the courts and so on. If it is punishment, well, then we're not doing a bad job. We are doing a very good job of punishing people for things that are kind of, maybe we could find better alternatives for. But there's also the question of, well, what happens, and is it appropriate to put a monetary tag on offences, whether it's a breach of duty, whether it's you know, a harm, an accidental or willful harm? Is that appropriate? And my response to that is, well, it's not very different than using a prison. The only difference is, when we put someone in prison, we're saying to the victim, your harm, the harm that you suffered, is equal to this much time versus this much money. So, I mean, I don't think there's an easy, straightforward answer to this, these issues that we're discussing here. But I do believe very strongly that the way things were done in the past, although not perfect, can give us, can maybe remind us of the principles that underpin the legal system and the justice system, in first principles, should I say. And that will hopefully, by having conversations like this, will begin to shift our consciousness towards those sorts of outcomes. And we as individuals and as a people will begin to expect more from what we can do with justice, what we can do with the courts and so on.
Tell me about the online course that you teach in Irish history. It looks very interesting.
Yeah, this is a project. It took me quite a while to actually put together, but it was partly as a need that I recognized for people to have access to this information. I mean, we're not educated about this in the schools in Ireland, for example. Irish people might know that such a system existed, but knows very little about it. So I wanted to kind of present that to people in a modern format, videos, online course. Like, it's today it's easier to digest than reading a book. It has 40 lessons that cover different aspects of Irish society. It's about 4 hours long, and it's up on Udemy. So once you have access to it, you have unlimited access. You can go through it in your own time. And anybody who is listening to the show, if you'd like to get access to it for a discount, you can use the coupon code Tom Woods in all capital letters, and you can get a discount for that as well.
Oh, okay. Well, look, I'm going to write that down because I'm going to put it on the show notes page, which is tomwoods.com/878. And I'll put that information, the link to the course and that nice code. And tell us also about your website, because that's full of interesting material as well.
Yeah, the website, I mean, as you know, I'm currently studying to do a master's right now in Prague, and it's taken my time away from kind of putting as much time as I would like into this project. But the website is up, and it has a lot of, you know, interesting blogs, and it has a library there with PDFs and books from other people, historical books. So it's really just to serve as I call it, a digital hedge school for early Irish law and culture, and just another resource for people to kind of get the information out there, to get them to maybe start thinking about the ideas and talking about the ideas with their friends.
Well, I'm really glad to have had a chance to talk to you about this. And I told you from the beginning, I don't want to answer every single conceivable question. I want to keep, because I want people to look at your stuff. I want people to research this further. You've done great work on it. And I'll tell you something, as somebody who does a lot of public speaking, Kevin's a good public speaker, and he doesn't read, heaven forbid, he does not read from notes, thank goodness. He's just up there talking, and the words that come out of his mouth are articulate, easy on the ears. And I, as you know, I'm not one who just gives out public speaking compliments unsolicited. If somebody asked me, I'll say, hey, yeah, you did a good job. That's about it. But I really enjoy, because I think I probably watched 5 of your videos. I don't generally do that.
So, wow. Okay.
Anyway.
I have a big smile here on my face. Thanks so much for the compliment.
Oh, that's great.
From you.
Are you gonna go back to Ireland after you're done in Prague?
I haven't decided yet. I like it here a lot, so we'll wait and see. But I'll be back and forth throughout the year, throughout the summer.
Sure. Now, on the other hand, if there were major, major revolutionary legal reforms in Ireland, you might think about that a bit more.
I think it's part of the problem is that there hasn't been any, and it doesn't look like there's going to be any soon. That's kind of encouraged me to stay away. I get too frustrated thinking about Irish politics, to be honest.
Yeah, I totally understand. Believe me, do I understand what that sentiment is all about. All right, thanks so much again. The resources for everybody are all up. If you don't remember them, they're linked at tomwoods.com/878. Best of luck in your work, Kevin. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Tom, and thanks for having me on. The best.
All right, everybody. Remember to check out my event at Yale University if you live in the area. It's free and open to the public, 7:30 p.m., April 4th. Details and the location, everything at tomwoods.com/events. If you're enjoying the show, consider becoming part of the elite as a supporting listener over at supportinglisteners.com. See you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.